Gary Courtney had a suite at the Mount Nelson Hotel, above the centre of Cape Town. There was, of course, no real alternative lodging for a gentleman traveller visiting the Cape of Good Hope. Its guest book read like a roll of honour. Statesmen and explorers, diamond magnates and big game hunters, gallant soldiers and illustrious peers of the realm, princes and admirals, had all made it their temporary home. The Courtney brothers, Gary and Sean, always had the same suite on the corner of the top floor, with a view on one side over the gardens, laid out by the governors of the Dutch East India Company, across the waters of Table Bay to the smoky blue mountains on the far side. On the other side, the grey rock ramparts of the mountain were so close that they blotted out half the sky. These legendary views did not distract Anna for a moment. She glanced quickly around the sitting room, then placed the carpet bag on the centre table and rummaged in it. She brought out the silver picture frame and showed it to Gary, who was hovering behind her indecisively. "Good Lord, that's Michael." He took the frame from her and stared hungrily at the photograph of No. 21 Squadron, taken only a few months previously. "It's so hard to believe." Gary broke off and gulped before going on. "Could I please have a copy of this made for myself?" Anna nodded, and Gary transferred his attention to the two photographs in the second leaf. "This is Santaine." He pronounced it in the English way. "Her mother." Anna touched the other. "This is Santaine." She corrected his pronunciation. "They are so much alike." Gary turned the photographs to catch the light. "Yet the mother is prettier, but the daughter, Santaine, has more force of character." Anna nodded again. "Now you know why she cannot be dead. She does not give up easily." Her manner became brusque. "But we are wasting time. We need a map." The hotel porter knocked on the door within minutes of Gary's call, and they spread the chart he brought between them. "I do not understand these things," Anna told him. "Show me where the ship was torpedoed." Gary had the position from the Inflexibles, navigating officer, and he marked it for her. "Do you see?" Anna was triumphant. "It is only a few centimetres from the land." She stroked the outline of Africa with her finger. "So close, so very close." "It's 100 miles. Even further, perhaps." "Are you always so miserable?" Anna snapped. "They told me that the tide runs towards the land, and the wind also was blowing so strongly towards the land. Anyway, I know my little girl." "The current runs at 4 knots, and the wind..." Gary made a quick calculation. "It's possible, but it would have taken days." Already, Gary was enjoying himself. He liked this woman's absolute assurance. All his life he had been a victim of his own doubts and indecision. He could not remember even once being as certain of a single thing as she seemed certain of everything. "So with the wind and water pushing her, where has she come ashore?" Anna demanded. "Show me." Gary penciled in his estimates. "I would say about here." "Ah!" Anna placed a thick, powerful finger on the map and smiled. When she smiled, she looked less like Chaka, Gary's huge, fierce mastiff, and Gary grinned with her. "Ah, so do you know this place?" "Well, I know a bit about it. I went with Buerta and Smuts in 1914 as a special correspondent for the Times. We landed here at Walvis Bay, the Bay of Wales." "Good, good," Anna cut him short. "So there is no problem. We will go there and find Santaine, yes? When can we leave? Tomorrow?" "It isn't quite that easy." Gary was taken aback. "You see, that is one of the fiercest deserts in the world." Anna's smile disappeared. "Always you find problems," she told him ominously. "Always you want to talk instead of doing things. And while you talk, what is happening to Santaine, eh? We must go quickly." Gary stared at her in awe. Already she seemed to know him intimately. She had recognized that he was a dreamer and a romantic, content to live in his imagination, to live through the characters of his writings, rather than in the real harsh world which frightened him so. "Now there is no more time for your talking. There are things to be done. First we will make a list of these things, and then we will do them. Now begin. What is the first thing?" Nobody had ever spoken to Gary like this, not at least since his childhood. With his military rank and his Victoria Cross, with his inherited wealth, his scholarly works of history, and his reputation as a philosopher, the world treated him with the respect accorded to a sage. He knew he did not truly merit any of these considerations, so they terrified and confused Gary, and his defence was to withdraw further into his imaginary world.
"While you make the list, take off your waistcoat."
"Madam?" Gary looked shocked.
"I am not madam, I am Anna. Now give me your waistcoat. There is a button missing."
He obeyed, quietly. "The first thing," Gary, in his shirt sleeves, wrote on a sheet of hotel notepaper, "is to cable the military governor in Windhoek. We will need permits. This is all a closed military area. We will need his cooperation. He will be able to arrange provisions and water points." Now that Gary had been prodded into taking action, he was working quickly. Anna sat opposite him, stitching on the button with those strong, capable fingers.
"What provisions? You will need the second list for those."
"Of course." Gary pulled another sheet towards him. "There!" Anna bit off the thread and handed him back his waistcoat.
"You can put it on now."
"Yes, mevrouw," said Gary meekly, but he could not remember when last he had felt so good. It was after midnight when Gary went out onto the small balcony of his bedroom in his dressing gown to take a last breath of night air, and while he reviewed the events of the day, the buoyant feeling of well-being remained with him. Between them, he and Anna had performed prodigies of labour. They already had a reply from the military governor in Windhoek. As always, the Courtney name had opened the door to wholehearted cooperation. Their reservations had been made on the passenger train that would leave tomorrow afternoon and take them over the Orange River and across the wastes of Namaqualand and Bushmanland, 4 days' travel, to Windhoek. They had even completed the major part of outfitting the expedition. Gary had spoken on the telephone, an instrument which he usually viewed with grave misgivings, to the owner of Stutterford's general dealer stores. The stores he required would be packed in wooden cases, the contents of each clearly labelled on it, and delivered to the railway station the following afternoon. Mr. Stutterford had given Gary his personal assurance that it would all be ready in time, and had sent one of the green motor vans up to the Mount Nelson Hotel with a selection of safari clothing for both Gary and Anna. Anna had rejected most of Mr. Stutterford's offerings as being either too expensive or too frivolous.
"I am not the poule,"
and she chose long, thick calico skirts and heavy lace-up boots with hobnailed soles, flannel underwear, and only at Gary's insistence, "The African sun is a killer," a cork solar topi with a green neck flap. Gary had also arranged a transfer of £3,000 to the Standard Bank in Windhoek to cover the expedition's final outfitting. It had all been done swiftly, decisively, and efficiently. Gary took a long draw on his cigar and flicked the butt over the edge of the balcony, then turned back into his bedroom. He dropped his dressing gown over the chair and climbed in between white sheets as crisp as lettuce leaves, and switched out the bedside light. Instantly all his old misgivings and self-doubts came crowding out of the darkness.
"It's madness," he whispered,
and in his mind's eye saw again those terrible deserts, shimmering endlessly in the blinding heat, 1,000 miles of coastline, swept by a cruel current so cold that even a strong man could survive in those waters for only a few hours, before hypothermia sucked the life out of him. They were setting out to look for a young girl of delicate breeding, a pregnant girl, who had last been seen plunging from the high deck of a stricken liner into the icy dark sea 100 miles from this savage coast. What were their chances of finding her? He flinched from even trying to estimate them.
"Madness," he repeated, miserably,
and suddenly he wished that Anna was there to bolster him. He was still trying to find an excuse to summon her from a single bedroom at the end of the corridor when he fell asleep.